Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's a Wednesday, November 12th. And before we start lecture, we're going to look at the schedule, but I probably also want to see if SI has any announcements. Any announcements from SI?
No, I moved the session to Friday.
Yeah, so the session is going to be Friday instead of today. Instead of today, it's moved to Friday. I think everybody got an email on that anyway. All right, let's take a look at the schedule. It's kind of scary. Today's the 12th, which means that next time, Monday, you have a lecture exam, exam number 3. And it's going to cover 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, but not the material that we're covering today, which is heart. So starting with 19, that will be on the last test. All right, so everybody knows that's there. Now, what do you need for this test? Shout it out. What do you need? Scantron, yeah. I think it's the 882E, 882ES pencil. And what else? Yeah, picture ID, please. Picture ID and a really good eraser. Make sure it works. Check it out with your pencil. And, of course, to speed things up, put your Scantron in the correct lab period when you turn your test in and show me your ID, because then I can just enter it without looking for you, because there's 4 sections in here. There's separate classes in Blackboard. So I would just have to hunt around too much to find you. All right, so that's the schedule. Okay, any questions on that? Great. All right, well, we didn't finish endocrine system as far as I recall last time. And so what I want to say about that, maybe go back to the adrenal gland. Yeah, let's go back to the adrenal gland. We talked about that, but just kind of as a review. You should know where the adrenal gland is located. Let's see what I got here. It's heart. Bless you. All right, so adrenal glands, they're right on top of the kidneys. All right, so here's the adrenal gland. When you look at this adrenal gland, you can see that there's some structures inside the adrenal gland, and as a matter of fact, we break it up into the superficial layer we call the cortex, and the deep layer we call the medulla. So that's easily seen on this slide, right? And there are even some layers within these layers that we're not too terribly concerned with in here. But what you should know, what should you know about the adrenal medulla? What does it secrete? It's part of the sympathetic nervous system, so it secretes epinephrine, but mostly epinephrine and a little bit of norepinephrine. And in those cases, it's going to act like a hormone. They're going to be secreted, picked up by the blood, taken everywhere. Even though you might think of norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter, in this case, it's not. It's really a neurohormone. All right, so that's the medulla. The cortex secretes basically 3 kinds of hormones: mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, and androgens. Where are we? Oh, yeah, right here. Okay. And cholesterol is a necessary precursor molecule for each of those hormones. Corticosteroids are involved with glucose metabolism. They help to increase blood glucose concentration. It is secreted under periods of stress, and of course, that's when you need more energy in your body. A good example of a corticosteroid would be cortisone, right, or cortisol as well. All right, so they help the body deal with stressful situations. The other kind of steroid is a mineralocorticoid, and as the name suggests, it's involved with adjusting the level of some minerals in your body. And those minerals are specifically sodium and potassium. And an example of a mineralocorticoid will be aldosterone, and aldosterone helps resorb sodium that's going to be lost in urine, and it puts back that sodium into your body, and it helps with the excretion of potassium. So when you think of aldosterone and sodium and potassium, just always realize that sodium and potassium are going to go in opposite directions. One is going to go into your body, the other is going to be leaving your body. What goes in is sodium, what leaves is potassium. And so on a test, whether it's a board exam or whatever, you might get a question about aldosterone, and the answer might be, well, it secretes both sodium and potassium. That obviously will be the wrong answer because they're both going in the same direction, right? Or it might say aldosterone aids in the reabsorption of sodium and potassium. And again, that can't be the right answer because sodium and potassium are going in the same direction. You got to look for an answer where sodium and potassium go in opposite directions, right? And hopefully there's only one answer and you'll get it right. Mineralocorticoid, aldosterone, and when sodium is resorbed from that filtrate, that part of the fluid in your kidney that will become urine, water goes along with it. So it's a way of resorbing water, and that's put back into your cardiovascular system, and that has an effect on blood pressure that will maintain blood pressure, keep it from falling, or maybe even increase blood pressure as a result. Right? So when we put fluids into our blood vessels, the pressure in those blood vessels increases. A good model for you to think of, say you have a tire and it's low on pressure. Do you put air in or do you take air out to increase the pressure inside that tire? Yeah, obviously you have to take pressure or take air and put it inside that tire, right, to increase the pressure. All right, and your body does the same thing for blood pressure. Puts fluid in the cardiovascular system when your pressure is low. And we're going to probably talk about some of those things. All right, mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, where do they come from? Where do they come from? What gland? The adrenal gland, right on top of the adrenal, and even specifically, more specifically, the adrenal. Wow, you guys are asleep. Yeah, the adrenal cortex right here. Okay, the adrenal cortex also secretes some androgens, right, that we talked about. That's a male sex hormone. Pineal gland, we mentioned. That's not so interesting. But that's going to take us to the pancreas. All right, the pancreas is in the abdomen, located very close to the posterior abdominal wall. And the pancreas is interesting because it's kind of a complicated gland. It's both endocrine and exocrine. All right, so the things that it secretes into a duct comes from the exocrine part of that gland, and then there are hormones that are secreted into the blood from the pancreas. When we get into the digestive tract, we'll look at the exocrine function of the pancreas, but today we're just going to look at the endocrine function. And for this class, the two hormones that you should know something about from the pancreas are going to be insulin, which you've heard of before, I'm sure, and glucagon. You might not have heard of glucagon, but if you know something about the musculoskeletal system, something about the autonomic nervous system, and something about your car, you will probably know what the relationship of insulin and glucagon are to each other. They're going to be antagonists to each other. And remember, antagonism is necessary, or it makes for a very easy control of a parameter like blood glucose levels, right? It allows for precise control and balance so that blood glucose can be maintained in a very narrow range, and as it should. So insulin decreases blood sugar. And when is it a good idea to decrease blood sugar? When it starts to increase. Yeah, when it starts to increase too high, insulin is secreted in a normal individual, and that allows insulin to enter cells in your body, and then the glucose level decreases in the blood. And then in different parts of the body, that glucose can be used for different purposes. Maybe make glycogen, or maybe you can make ATP out of it. All right, so the insulin, you should think of insulin as the passport that's necessary for cells to absorb glucose. And without that signal there, those cells are going to start to starve to death. So it's really important. If somebody has diabetes mellitus where there's an abnormality in insulin secretion or in the receptors that bind insulin, that they should try to control their blood glucose levels. And insulin comes from the beta cells. Alpha cells, on the other hand, secrete glycogen. And glycogen works the other way. Right, when blood glucose starts to drop, glucagon is secreted from the pancreas, and that increases blood glucose levels. So when might your blood glucose levels start to decline? What conditions? When you're hungry, absolutely when you're hungry. Okay. But what are you doing? What are you doing if you're hungry? Or what are you not doing when you're hungry? You're not eating. Yeah, we call that a fasted state. So there are basically two states we can be in. We can be in a fasted state when we're not eating, or we could be in a fed state. In a fasted state, glucagon is secreted, and that helps the breakdown of glycogen, and glycogen is a storage form for glucose. So glucagon breaks down glycogen, and then the glucose is secreted into the blood, more specifically by the liver. Right? The liver is really good at doing that. All right, so we got insulin and glucagon, and I mentioned, it reminds me of a couple muscles. What are a couple muscles do they remind you of? What would be an example? You need two muscles, right? Because I got two hormones right here. Okay, and what's the relationship between insulin and glucagon? Uh-oh, I feel a sneeze coming on. Oh no. What's the relationship between glucagon and insulin? They're antagonistic to each other. So what am I asking you? I'm asking you, give me two muscles that are antagonistic to each other. What's your favorite pair? Biceps and triceps. Yeah, that's right. So you can move the tip of your finger around when you get pulled over by that person in the fancy blue uniform badge and sidearm right on a Friday night. So that's important. What else did I mention? Your car. What's an antagonistic mechanism in your car? Accelerator and brake pedal. Yeah, you wouldn't dream of driving your car with either of these. And tell the truth, you wouldn't dream of being alive without both glucagon and insulin. You want both of those so you have precise control and balance, just like your car, right? Just like your musculoskeletal system. All right, so remember, alphas secrete glucagon and the betas secrete insulin. And these cells have receptors for glucose, right? So these endocrine cells are responding to chemicals that are in your body. What kind of control was that? That was, I think, one of the first things we talked about. What were the three kinds of control? We got neural control, when an endocrine gland secretes its product, its hormone, as a result of stimulation from a nerve. That's neural control, right? There's hormonal control. Some endocrine glands will be waiting from a signal from another endocrine gland. Well, we'll be able to detect a hormone. And then there is the last one, which is this one, which is what we call humoral, not hormonal, but humoral. Humoral just means substances other than hormones that are in the blood. Here's an example, glucose, right? Its effect on the pancreas. Okay, thymus gland. Where is the thymus gland located? I think I picked on this particular location on your first exam, because when you mention it, you sound really educated, and that's great. What body compartment is that in? One that you had never heard of, yeah, before taking this class. And you're pointing to it right here, right in the smack in the middle of your body. Your thorax, what is that compartment right here between your lungs, right? It's your thoracic cavity, but I want smaller than that. It is your, ow, I heard it, it's your mediastinum. Thanks for reminding me, I forgot, mediastinum, okay? And remember, pronounce it like that because it has a little swing to it. Well, the thymus gland is an important gland for your immune system. There's a special kind of lymphocyte. You know what lymphocytes look like, right? Because you were tested on that in a practicum. And a T lymphocyte in particular is part of your immune system. It's a contact killer. So when it runs into a foreign cell in your body, it will grab onto it and break it apart, right? We call that lysis, when it breaks something apart, but it actually has to physically touch that particle in order to destroy it, so it's a contact killer. There's other ways your body can fight things with antibodies, but the T lymphocyte is for contact killing, and there are precursor cells to these lymphocytes in the thymus, and they develop and gain competency, right, which means that they're able to then wander around through your circulatory system and look for things that don't belong in your body. Okay. So that's the thymus gland. Gonads. Who could give me an example of a gonad? It's a gonad. It's for sexual reproduction. There are two different kinds. Yeah, testes and ovaries. We haven't talked about them in anatomy yet, but probably most people have heard of these things before, right? And so a gonad is either an ovary or a testes. Testes we find in males, ovaries we find in females. These organs produce sex cells for us, and the sex cells, generally, we call them gametes. A gamete is a sex cell, and we have some different examples. Males produce sperm, females produce eggs, or oocytes. And those gametes are like a half-human cell. They have half the genetic material than most cells in our body. So that when an egg and sperm join together, then it becomes a whole human cell with all of the DNA, all the chromosomes that are necessary in most cases. But you could think that the males are a little deficient. And we'll talk about that in the last lecture. Okay? Males don't have as much genetic material as females do. And that's really a shame. Okay, because that puts us at puts us males at a disadvantage. Right? And we never get any credit for that. I need to sensitize you to that when we get into the reproductive system. All right, so what do these gonads do besides producing gametes? They are endocrine glands. They secrete hormones. In the male, there is only one, and it is testosterone. Right? Or a general class will be called androgens. And androgens promote the formation of sperm, right, and with the help of some hormones from the anterior pituitary that we talked about, for instance, like LH and FSH. And testosterone maintains secondary sex characteristics. What are some secondary sex characteristics? If you look at a male, could you tell that that person is a male or a female in most cases? Or if they talk, could you tell? Why? Why? How could you recognize male from female? Deeper voice. That's right, because our voice on that hour, males' voice boxes are bigger, so they resonate at a lower frequency because their larynx is bigger. Bigger, stronger muscles. That's based on testosterone. Bigger, stronger bones. So males are a little bit more protected from osteoporosis because of that. Okay? So those are some examples. Oh, hair. Hair. More hair. Coarser hair all over the body. All right, that's the result of testosterone. In the female, the reproductive organ is ovary, and ovary secretes two hormones, estrogen and progesterone. Estrogen kind of likes works like testosterone that the male has, right? Estrogen maintains secondary sex characteristics. What is a secondary sex characteristic for a female? I'm not quite sure. I think I heard you say breast. Yes, breast development. What else? Smaller bones, smaller muscles, hair, which is not so coarse and thick. Also, it helps regulate uterine cycle and menstrual cycles, right? And progesterone is necessary for that as well. But progesterone is... The primary reason why I want you to think about progesterone is because it helps maintain pregnancy. When that hormone is at a high level, then the body has the concept that it is pregnant. Right? So what is that period of time when somebody is pregnant? What is that called? Okay, when a fetus is developing inside a uterus, what do we call that period of time? That's called gestation, right? Gestation. And so here we have a word. We have progesterone. That's just a contracted form of progestational hormone. Progestational. So this is a kind of hormone that secretes pregnancy. Okay, or maintains the uterus for implantation of a fertilized egg or pregnancy. All right, so again, look at this. Females have two sex hormones and males only have one. Again, us males feel really bad about that. Okay. All right, so that is it for endocrine system. And anybody has a question? We're going to look at a whole bunch of these profiles of estrogen and progesterone and LH and FSH in the female when we get to the last chapter. That's a really interesting part of the class. All right, but you should know a little bit about it in the endocrine chapter. Okay, any questions? No questions? Even though this is sort of about sex? No questions? Okay. All right, we'll put it away. And then we're going to go to the heart. All right, and I'm going to put the endocrine away. Did I kill the heart? No, it's still there. Nice. Okay, so we'll put heart here. Okay, so the heart is part of the cardiovascular system. Does everybody have your notes ready for that? So cardiovascular system includes the heart and blood vessels. And even some lymphatic blood vessels, lymphatic vessels, they're not blood vessels. That's the cardiovascular system. All right? But we're going to break it down. We're going to look at the heart as a chapter, blood vessels as a chapter and lymphatic vessels as a chapter by themselves, right? So we're going to break it down into those three pieces, which is good when you're talking about a complicated thing. All right, so first thing we should know about the heart is has something to do with its shape, right? And when I picked up a heart that's diseased, let me pick up a heart that's not quite so diseased if I have it. Oh, here's a good example, okay? So when we just look at the heart inside somebody's, oh, where's the heart located once again? Where is it located? You could say thoracic cavity, but there's a better way. Yeah, mediastinum, right? And the thymus gland kind of covers these vessels up over here, right? It kind of looks like, in two dimensions, a triangle. But, of course, it's really a three-dimensional organ, so you could think of it as a pyramid. But it's an upside-down pyramid, and it's tilted. And what do we call the point, the top of a pyramid? That is the, or the top of a pyramid is, or a triangle is the apex, right? So that's really easy to find. And a triangle has a base. Here's the base of the heart. That's the widest part. So that's easy to tell. And the interesting thing is, in this class, we've looked at a bunch of structures, and we found that if you have a hand on one side of your body, what do you have on the other? You got another hand, right? If you have a kneecap on one side of your body, what have you got on the other? You got another kneecap or patella. So far we've looked at a lot of bilateral symmetry. But when we get to the heart, we're going to see that there is no longer strict bilateral symmetry. And as a matter of fact, I think you know that because on what side of your body do you find more heart compared to the other? Where is your heart mostly located? Is it right smack in the middle with the apex pointing straight down like that? No. Okay. It's mostly on what side? Yeah, it's mostly on the left side. Well, it doesn't switch over like I'm mentioning right here. It doesn't switch over. It's angulated. The base pretty much is right smack in the middle of the body. But as you go from base to apex, right, it's angled to the left. So the ventricles are more on the left side of your body. And there's even a little notch inside the lungs right here to make room for the heart. Right? So if you go from base to apex, it's angled over to the left side. But what's not shown on this diagram is that the base is pretty deep inside your thoracic cavity. And when you go from base to apex, not only does the apex move over to the left, but it also moves anteriorly. Right, so it's doubly angulated. It's angulated to the left, and it's angulated anteriorly. So that, and a lot of times, the apex is even pounding up against the wall of the thorax. And when it bounces up against the wall of the thorax, it's actually easy to feel. It's easy to palpate with your fingertips. You can just feel your heart just pounding up against the wall of the thorax. And that's given a name. It's a particular point. It's called point of maximal impulse. Right, but we usually don't always talk about it like that. We just say, what, PMI, point of maximal impulse. So if you really want to find out where somebody's heart is located without opening them up or getting an X-ray or MRI or CAT scan, you can always find that PMI and know exactly where the heart is. Right, so that's a pretty good indication. And as a matter of fact, if somebody's really skinny, you can even just see it. You can just see the chest wall kind of pound out every time the heart beats. Okay, so the heart is angulated in two directions, right? From, it goes to the left, but it also goes anteriorly, so we say it has a biaxial tilt. So we lose some of that asymmetry. All right, so let's look at some layers around the heart and some membranes. Okay, and what do we call a membrane that surrounds a cavity that's not open to the outside world? That's a serous membrane. What kind of membrane lines a cavity that is open to the outside world, like oral cavity, nasal cavity, reproductive tract, urinary tract? Yeah, that's a mucous membrane, right? Mucus versus serous. And it just so happens that a serous is a little bit more complicated than a mucous membrane. And it can be broken down into some distinct pieces. How many pieces should we break a serous membrane down into? Three. Yeah, three. Really good. You guys are recalling that. Yep, three layers. There is the membrane that's right on the visceral organ. In this particular case, it's going to be the heart. There's a membrane right on the surface of the heart. And then that membrane is going to be continuous, and it's going to line the mediastinum, right? But now there's going to be a space between those two membranes, right? And we call that the serous space filled with serous fluid. All right, so the visceral pericardium is the visceral division of that serous membrane. The part of that membrane that lines the mediastinum is the parietal division, and that space between them is filled with fluid. Okay, and sometimes we call that pericardial fluid that's in that space. So where do I have a nice picture of that? Really nice picture, probably right here, sort of, not really. Where are these nice membranes located? Okay, right here. So here we have the heart, right? Here's the apex, here's the base. Let's look at one little layer up by this one chamber. Some of you that have lab already know what this chamber is. This is the left atrium. Sometimes we just call it the LA for left atrium. And let's look at the wall. All right, so we zoomed way into this region. Here is the chamber, the atrium, the left atrium. And here is the wall of the heart. But we're talking about that membrane on the surface of the heart. All right, so we're going to talk about this layer here. This layer that's right on the surface of the heart, right, that's what we call the visceral pericardium, right? Visceral pericardium of this serous membrane. But it's also called the epicardium because it's sitting, what, on top of the heart, epicardium. So it's got two different names depending on whether we're going to talk about the membrane surrounding the heart or if we're going to talk about layers that make up the heart. If we're talking about membranes, then this is the visceral pericardium. Right, if we're talking about the layers of the heart, then we're going to ignore this stuff up over here and just call this the epicardium. So depending on what you want to talk about, you pick the proper term. All right, so here is the visceral pericardium, and then it lines, right, the cavity that the heart is in. Anybody remember what the name of the cavity that the heart is in? It's in the mediastinum, but it's also in its own little special cavity called the pericardium. Pericardial cavity. All right, so here is the layer of the serous membrane that lines the pericardial cavity. So we got the parietal division, the visceral division, and then the serous space filled with serous fluid, right, which we could call maybe even the pericardial cavity or pericardial fluid in this area right here. All right, so that's the typical serous membrane. All right, but remember, your heart is beating very, actually kind of violently inside your chest. It's really beating your chest up. These serous membranes are not strong enough to hold the heart up, especially since it's moving so vigorously. There is an additional layer, okay, that we call the fibrous pericardium, right? And that's what actually defines where the pericardial cavity is. But it's really not part of the serous membrane system around the heart. It's a special one. Just like there was a special membrane system around the brain. What do we call that special membrane system around the brain? Part of it was really tough. The meninges, right? And the dura mater was a part of that, and the dura mater is really, really tough and strong. All right, so think of dura mater and think of the fibrous pericardium as being that strong layer that's suspending the heart. It's holding the heart in position, and that's its job. Okay, the fibrous pericardium. All right, so that's the serous. Visceral, pericardium, serous fluid in the serous cavity, and then here is the parietal division. All right, so I think you should be pretty familiar with that. All right, so if we're not talking about the membranes around the heart, but we want to talk about layers that actually make the heart up, right, then we need to change our focus a little bit. And let's start with this superficial layer. Right, and then we have a middle layer, and then we have a deep layer, the deepest layer. So we've got three layers. If we're talking about layers, this one right here, we're not going to call this the visceral pericardium, although you would probably know that. Right? But it's probably better to call this the epicardium. Right? Epicardium, sitting on top of the heart. The layer that's made up of cells that contract, or the muscle cells, this is what we call the myocardium. And then on the inside of the heart that lines every little cavity on the inside, this is the endocardium. And you have to know that for your quiz for this week. And Monday, Monday group has lab. Oh, Monday has lab, right? Oh, I didn't notice that. Oh, yeah, but that's not a practicum. Never mind. Okay, I don't have to make up a practical test. All right, so you got epicardium, myocardium, endocardium, and that's just like bone. What is the outer membrane on bone called? The periosteum, right, surrounding a bone. And what's the membrane on the inside of all the cavities of bone? That's the endosteum, right? So endocardium matches up really nice with endosteum, but the peri and epi don't match up quite so nice with bone and heart, but that's okay. The endocardium is really smooth. You're going to see it in lab. It's smooth and slippery. And why do you think that might be a really good idea? Why should this be smooth and slippery, lining all these heart chambers? Because what's in this chamber? Yeah, there's blood. And this blood is flowing around. And if blood is mistreated, it likes to coagulate. It likes to form a solid. Well, when blood is in your heart, really good idea to keep it a fluid. We don't want it to solidify and just form a plug, because that would be fatal. All right, so blood can flow and slip and slide right over the endocardium without any chance of causing a blood clot, as long as it's healthy. But it can get diseased, and maybe we'll talk about some of those circumstances. All right, so that's the membrane system. That's the layers of the heart. Let's go back to, I think, maybe the first picture that's in this chat. Second picture. All right, which is this one right here. This is maybe the most important picture in the whole chapter, though it leaves a lot of detail out, but it gives us an overview of the cardiovascular system. So it's hugely important. Kind of reminds me of that initial picture of the nervous system, where we broke down all the divisions of the nervous system, you know, sensory and motor and somatic and autonomic and parasympathetic and sympathetic, right? So it's really good to break the cardiovascular system down. And right here in the center, you see the heart. Here's the apex, here's the base of the heart. Okay, when you look at this slide, how many colors do you see? You see two, right? You should see probably a red and a blue. That's close to blue, right? Is that blue? Hopefully not purple, maybe purple. Pink? Blue, okay. Red and blue. All right, so how many colors do you see? Two colors. There, how many sides does the heart have? It has two, right? So it kind of matches up with the colors. There's a right and a left side to the heart, okay? And so the heart really is two pumps that's glued together right smack in the middle, right? The left one is one pump, the right one is another pump. And these pumps pump blood to different locations in your body, right? So how many colors do you see? Two. How many sides of the heart are there? Two. How many circulations are there in your body? There's going to be two, once again. All right? There's a circulation where the left ventricle pumps blood into, and it delivers blood everywhere in your body. We call this the systemic circulation. All right? And this is a circulation which is delivering nutrients and oxygen to cells in your body. That's one circulation. That comes from the left ventricle. And the second circulation that starts in the right ventricle pumps blood only to the lungs. And that's the pulmonary circulation. So the heart has two sides, right? It's got two circulations, and one is systemic, one is pulmonary. Can you tell from this diagram which one is more extensive, which one is longer? Is it the pulmonary or systemic circulation? Yeah, you have to use your mind to kind of look at that. It's not really drawn to scale because, look, we've shrunk this little person down. It's not the same size as these lungs. And indeed, the systemic circulation is a lot longer, right? It's much more complex compared to the pulmonary circulation. So it requires more pressure to push blood through the systemic circulation. So that side of the heart has to work harder. What happens to a muscle when it gets regular exercise? It gets bigger and stronger, right? So if we look at the left side of the heart compared to the right, you're going to notice that the left side of the heart is the muscle, or the myocardium is bigger and thicker. Remember, myocardium is that layer. The myocardium of the right ventricle is thinner because it does not have to work as hard because it's only pumping blood through the pulmonary circulation. Okay. All right, this slide is also really good because it's got some arrows on it, right? We said that these chambers down here, right, pump blood into this blood vessel, right? And this chamber pumps blood into this blood vessel, and these arrows depict the direction of blood flow. All right, so these two vessels, this one here and this one here, these two, what direction is blood flowing? Toward the heart or away from the heart? Away from the heart. When blood is flowing away from the heart through a blood vessel, we know that that blood vessel is called an artery. That's a definition of an artery. All right? It's the direction of blood flow, not what is contained in the blood. All right, so here is the aorta. That's an artery. Here is the pulmonary artery. Blood is flowing away from the heart. All right, but what could you tell me about these two arteries? What do you notice about these two arteries? Wow, I can even tell. They're different colors. That's right. All right, so the different colors doesn't have anything to do whether this is an artery or a vein. It's only the direction of blood flow. So here's a really good example. And what these colors mean is that red signifies blood that is relatively high in oxygen, relatively low in CO2, right? And those cells need oxygen. But this artery right here, since it's blue, is relatively low in oxygen, right? So can an artery contain blood that's low in oxygen? And the answer is yes, if it belongs to the pulmonary circulation. So you can't say deoxygenated or oxygenated and define whether it's an artery or a vein. It's only the direction of blood flow. All right, so here is a blood vessel, and it's bringing blood back to the heart. Here's a blood vessel bringing blood back to the heart. By definition, what does it make these vessels? Are these arteries? These are not. These are veins. Right? So a vein, by definition, is a vessel that brings blood back to the heart. And what can you tell me about this pulmonary vein and these vena cava right here? What's different about them? They're both bringing blood to the heart, but what's different about them? The colors are different, right? So the pulmonary veins are high, relatively high in oxygen. The vena cava right here are relatively low. So again, the substance that's being carried in the blood doesn't determine whether it's an artery or a vein. It's only what? The direction of blood flow. Okay. That's important. So I see this, very nice. The other thing I see on this slide are the three basic kinds of blood vessels where blood flows through. I see a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart. We call that a? It's got a specific name, but generally this is an artery. Okay, it goes through this network over here, and then it flows back to the heart via a vein. The system right here that connects an artery to a vein, this is what we call a capillary. These are really microscopic, super thin blood vessels. And a capillary is the only place in the cardiovascular system where something that's in the blood can leave and get into tissue spaces, or something that's in a tissue space and enter a blood vessel. Right? And that's a capillary. We call that exchange. Exchange can only happen in a capillary, not a vein, not an artery, not a small artery that we call an arteriole, not a small vein that we call a venule. If something's in an artery, it's trapped, can't get out. Right? If something's in a vein, it's trapped, it can't get out. It can only get out through a, what kind of vessel can something leave the blood? Only a capillary. And we'll look at the anatomical reasons for that in just a little bit. All right, so you see the three main kinds of blood vessels, artery, capillaries, and veins, and now you know the functions of those three different kinds of blood vessels. What's the function of an artery? It carries blood away from the heart. What's the function of a capillary? Exchange, in one word, that's great. I like that bullet point. And what's the function of a vein? Brings blood back to the heart. Okay, so you guys now know some physiology of the cardiovascular system. That's pretty good. All right, well, we're going to get back to the heart. So one of the things that I ask a lot is how many chambers does the heart have? And you see it on this diagram. If you prepared for the quiz in lab, you're familiar with it. I see 1, 2, 3, 4. And indeed, there are four chambers. Right? And you can see the right and left side. So here is the right side of the heart. Here's the left side. Right? So there are two chambers on the left, two chambers on the right. The ones that are on the top, the superior part, these are what we call atria. The ones on the bottom are much more muscular. These are the ventricles. So you could label these. Here is the right ventricle. Here's the left ventricle. Here's the LA. Here's the RA. Right, here's the LV, here is the RV. Sometimes we just abbreviate it just like that. And I see the separation between the ventricles, between the right and left ventricles. What do we call a separation? Like this thing in your nose, that's a septum, right? You're right. So here is the interventricular septum. And it has all, it has two of the layers. It's got endocardium and myocardium. Okay. Well, do you see these arrows? They point in a direction. Do you see any arrows anywhere in here that is double-ended? Do you see an arrow that goes both directions? But what do you see these arrows? They're only pointing in one direction. That's really important. When blood flows through the heart, it should only flow with one kind of pattern, right? And it should flow what we call antegrade or forward. It should never flow back, which we call retrograde. Under certain circumstances, for a little while, it does normally. But in general, I want you to think that the flow pattern through the heart, right, is antegrade. Right, starting with this atrium, then it goes into the ventricle. From a ventricle, it goes into an artery. Right, so here is the ventricle. When it contracts, it produces really high pressure, squirts a bunch of blood into this artery, and you know that to be the pulmonary artery in this case. Right, so all that blood gets up over here, and then when the ventricle relaxes, that blood in this artery is going to go back into this ventricle. But that would kill the heart. Right, so there is a special structure that prevents that retrograde flow of blood, and I see it right here. That is a valve. All right, so how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? And maybe you don't know right now, but you should just say four, just like the number of chambers, four and four. Right, so it's easy to remember that. Here is one. It's at the root of the pulmonary artery. That is the pulmonary valve. Here is the aorta right here, and it connects up over here. It's got a valve. That is the aortic valve. Okay, so those are, these two valves are very similar. The pulmonary and aortic valve, very similar. We'll look at some more details, especially in lab. All right, so that's two. How many more do we need? We need two more. Okay. So here are the atria. These are the chambers that collect blood from either the pulmonary or systemic circulation. And what can you tell me about the wall thickness of an atrium compared to a ventricle? Which one is thicker? Yeah, ventricle is a lot thicker. So the ventricle is a lot stronger, develops much more pressure than an atrium. So when the ventricle contracts, not only, and here's the left one, not only does it want to pump blood into the aorta, it also wants to pump blood into the atrium, the left atrium, but again, that would kill the heart. So what prevents that retrograde flow? Another valve. These are called atrioventricular valves, right, between an atrium and a ventricle. Here's one on the left side of the heart, here's one on the right side of the heart, and they have names based on their structure. The one on the right side has three of these little trapdoors, which we call leaflets, right? It has three. The one on the left side only has two. That's the basis of their name. So the one on the right we call the tricuspid because it has three flaps, and the one on the right only has two, right? And so we call that the bicuspid. Bicuspid is on the left. And the bicuspid has another name. Sometimes it's called the mitral valve. So mitral valve is on the left side of the heart as well. And people will use bicuspid and mitral in the same sentence, and you'll kind of shake your head and wonder, why are they doing that? Just because it's exactly the same. Okay? Okay. It's this valve right here. So, how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? All right. How many sides does the heart have? Two. And how many circulations, how many major circulations are in your body? Two. Do you know the names of those circulations? Yeah, what are they? Systemic and pulmonary. Which one needs a stronger muscle to pump blood through it? Systemic. Yeah. And what ventricle pumps blood through the systemic circulation? Yeah, the left ventricle. Nice. So that's awesome, important stuff. So that's why I like this diagram. It shows things very nicely. Right. It's not labeled exchange for these capillaries, but down here it is. Right. You should be aware of that. All right. So that's a pretty good overview in a very diagrammatic way of the cardiovascular system. Okay. So we got some pictures of the heart. So here is something that will help you in lab as well. So remember, the basic shape of the heart is a triangle. Here's the apex, here's the base. right? A lot of blood vessels that nourish the myocardium, the muscles of the heart, right, run along the base and then project down toward the apex. So here's one projecting straight down to the apex. Here's one that's projecting straight down to the apex. There's one, right, if it was going to project straight down to the apex, it would go like this, but it doesn't end up there, does it? It starts here, and then it starts to move over to the right. It's on a diagonal. This is the only coronary, all these blood vessels, since they work with the heart, are called coronary blood vessels. This one right here is the only coronary blood vessel that is angulated, and you'll see it kind of wrap around the heart like a candy cane stripe or a barbershop stripe on a barbershop pole, if you've seen these things. Okay, so you can always tell this particular blood vessel, and it's in a sulcus. What's a sulcus once again? It's a groove or a depression, right? So these blood vessels hang out in that depression, but they don't take up the whole sulcus. The other parts of that sulcus are taken up with this pericardial fat. And fat, you know, kind of looks yellow or might look white. The muscle looks red, so there's always really good contrast between the muscle and the sulcus. So it's easy to see, even from across the room in a real heart. Right? So you're going to really like that. And you're going to find this diagonal stripe on the heart, and it's called the anterior longitudinal sulcus. And how is it named on this thing? Anterior interventricular artery in the sulcus. All right, so some people call it interventricular because it kind of is right between the left and right ventricle. But I think more commonly in hospitals it's called the anterior longitudinal sulcus. And what side of the heart is it on? Is it on right or left, anterior or posterior? Okay, and the name tells you. It is what? The anterior interventricular or anterior longitudinal. So it's on the anterior side of the heart. So when you look at this heart, it's like looking at my heart, right? Because you're looking at the anterior side of me. This side over here is what? The right or left? That's the right. Over here is the left. Same thing for this heart. So here is the right side of the heart. Here's the left side. And of course, if we were to look at the ventricles, we could confirm that. And you will confirm that in lab. Really nice and easy. Okay, talked about valves, layers, blood flow through the heart. We kind of talked about it already. All right, so let's talk about, I'll point some of these things out. I think it's really easy to forget if I just talk about it, but maybe it will make sense when you study if I talk about it a little bit. All right, so here are the two chambers on the base of the heart. These are what we call, These are the atria, left atrium, right atrium. There's a part of an atrium that looks like a little flap of skin right here. It's on the edge, and sometimes it has a lot of little ridges or projections on it. That's what we call an auricle. Kind of reminded somebody of somebody's ear. Right? Some people use auricle and atrium interchangeably, but they're not really. So when somebody uses auricle, you kind of have to figure out what they're speaking about. Are they speaking about this piece of an atrium, or are they talking about the chamber? Right? Strictly speaking, the atrium is the chamber, the auricle is this little part of an atrium. Right? And that's how we're going to do it in this class. Right? The auricle is a part of an atrium, not an atrium altogether by itself. Right? And here is an auricle of the right atrium over here. So here is right ventricle. Right ventricle is going to pump blood into this blood vessel. It's going to carry blood away from the heart. So is this an artery or a vein? That's an artery. And it's going to take it to, it's going to enter the pulmonary circulation. So we call this the pulmonary artery. Right? And of course, one is going to go to the left lung, one's going to go to the right. So these are what we call the pulmonary arteries here. Where they join together, sometimes we call this the pulmonary trunk. But indeed, you should recognize that as an artery, right? Okay. And when you start doing your dissections and when you look at a heart today, this is the first blood vessel you're going to see from the anterior side of the heart. It's going to look big and strong. It's going to remind you of another artery that's easier to recall, and that is the aorta, right? But look where the aorta is. It is posterior to the pulmonary trunk. They're going to look very similar. But you can tell the aorta because it's behind this artery that is coming from the right ventricle. And if you're clever, you can look in the left ventricle and look deep inside the ventricle and actually see where the aorta connects up to the left ventricle. But it's pretty deep. Might be a little bit hard to see. All right, nicely color-coded, right? Deoxygenated, relatively oxygenated blood. But why are both of these things arteries, even though they have different colors? Why are these arteries? Both are arteries. They have different colors. So darn confusing. But I don't want you to be confused. Why is that? Why are these both arteries? Because they're taking blood away from the heart. All right? The blood is different, but at least it's going in the same direction. Okay. All right. Here is a blue blood vessel. It's bringing blood back to the right atrium. These are what we call vena cava. That just means big cavernous vein. And here, of course, is the inferior. Here's the superior. And since they're veins, which way is blood flowing? Into the heart, right? Into the right atrium. All right, so we've got superior, inferior vena cava. And what color are these? Nice and blue, means relatively deoxygenated. That's a vein. Here are some veins that are returning blood to the heart. Kind of hard to picture this a little bit because it's not connected to anything. I just see these little nubbins right here. But it is delivering oxygenated blood to the left atrium. That's why it's colored red, right? But if it's delivering blood to the heart, what are these things? Are these arteries or veins? These are veins, even though they're relatively high in oxygen. Again, it's only the direction of blood flow. I'm sorry if I'm putting you to sleep with that, but there's going to be a bunch of people that's really confusing to, but I understand why it is confusing, okay? So here is the systemic vein bringing blood back to the right atrium. We call these the vena cava. Here are the pulmonary veins bringing blood back from the lungs to the left atrium. And of course, that's oxygenated blood because where is it returning from? The lungs, which is where blood picks up oxygen, right? So if you just really think about it, it makes perfect sense. Okay. So when you get started in lab, you only have to really know three things about the heart. The first one is apex, really easy to see. Second thing is base, really easy to see. And the third thing is the anterior longitudinal sulcus, and then everything will just kind of fall into place. It will be kind of amazing because when you first look at a heart that's outside somebody's body just sitting on the table, it will look like a blob. It won't look like anything. Okay, so you need to get oriented. And how many things do you need to see to get oriented? Just these three things. Okay, and boom, you'll have a nice picture of a heart inside your mind if you can identify these three structures. Okay, all right, so here is an artery on the heart. It's a coronary blood vessel. It's an artery, and it's colored red. So I could ask you, this blood vessel right here, is this part of the systemic circulation or pulmonary circulation? It's an artery that's colored red. Okay? Okay. Here is, let's figure this out. That's a good mind twister. Here is a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart, right? And what color is it?
Red.
Taking blood away from the heart, so that's an artery. Can you remember what circulation this belongs to? The systemic circulation. So these coronary arteries belong to the systemic circulation, right? They match up with the aorta. So these coronary arteries are delivering oxygen to the heart, absolutely necessary to keep the heart alive and pumping. Right, these blue blood vessels then are going to be the coronary veins, part of the systemic circulation, right? So they're going to match up with the systemic circulation, right, for the aorta and the vena cava, red and blue. Well, it just so happens that oxygenated blood will leave the aorta in only two locations. The heart only has two coronary blood vessels. There's one that goes to what side of the heart is over here? This is the right side, so here is the right coronary artery. And then right through here, tucked underneath this auricle, is the left coronary, right? And then the left coronary bifurcates very early on to the circumflex. And then this is the left anterior descending. Sometimes it's called the interventricular coronary artery. You could use either. Most people call it the left anterior descending. Most people say this is the anterior longitudinal sulcus, but it might be helpful to know that it lies right between the ventricles. All right, and the coronary arteries and the coronary veins are part of the systemic circulation. All right, so here's a pretty good test. Remember, the vena cava are part of the systemic circulation. They're bringing blood back to, what chamber is this right here? Systemic circulation brings blood back to the right atrium. Here is a coronary vein. Where is it bringing blood back to? Right, it's a vein, so it's delivering blood back to the heart. Is it bringing it back to the left atrium or the right atrium? And an easy trick you can tell, look at the color. All right, it's bringing blood back to the right atrium, which again kind of confirms that it is part of the systemic circulation. Right? Pulmonary circulation brings blood back to the left atrium, right here. Okay, so that's some good things about this particular diagram. Oh, we said that the coronary arteries bring blood back to the right atrium. Here is a posterior view of the heart. Looks a little bit complicated, right? But here is a coronary vein, and where does it bring blood back to? You can see it bringing back right to the right atrium, if you actually look at it. Okay, that's all I want. Here is a good exam figure. The previous figure is not an exam figure, but this one is. You got to know all these details. First, you see the layers. You see the layers with lead lines? Indeed. Here's epicardium, here's endocardium, here's myocardium. What characteristic does the endocardium have? Smooth, slippery, right? Shouldn't be jagged. It gets that way sometimes, right? But since it's smooth and slippery, it also makes up the valves. So the valve leaflets or cusps are made out of endocardium. So what could you tell me about the valves? They are slippery and smooth, right? They can become diseased. They can be really rough. Right? They can have calcium deposits in them. They can have cholesterol deposits, which gets really hard. Right? And those things can actually generate blood clots when that happens. And probably all of us have them in our valves to some degree already. Okay. So you see how many chambers? 1, 2, 3, 4. The two superior ones are the atria, two inferior are the ventricles. Here is the right side of the heart. Here's the left side. Look at the thickness of the walls of the ventricle, so you can again confirm which is the right, which is the left. And now we're looking into the heart, so let's consider some of these structures inside the heart. I see some really nice valves. And how many valves again are there? 4. There are 2 atrioventricular valves, right? Atrioventricular, here's another atrioventricular valve. Sometimes they're called AB valves as a result. The one on the right side, you believe this is the right side of the heart right here? Convince yourself sometime, if not today, then tonight or tomorrow. Here is the right atrioventricular valve, and you don't see it here, so I'll have to tell you, it has 3 of these leaflets that flop back and forth. And hence, this name, the name for this valve is called the tricuspid because it has 3 of these leaflets. That's on the right side of the heart. Going back over to the left side, here is a leaflet, but the left side of the heart, the atrioventricular valve on the left side, only has 2 leaflets. So this is called the bicuspid. Right? So you could keep the terminology the same, tricuspid and bicuspid. Right? But another very common name is for bicuspid is mitral valve. Mitral and bicuspid are exactly the same. So what kind of valves are the tricuspid and mitral valves? What kind of valves are they? Where are they located? Between atrium and ventricle. They are atrioventricular valves. That prevents blood from going from a ventricle back into an atrium. I see a couple other valves. They look totally different, right? Here's one at the base of the pulmonary artery. So hence, we're going to call this the pulmonary valve. And notice, well, it doesn't have all these other structures. I got to go back and talk about these structures. So the structure of these valves are what we call semilunar. So here's a semilunar valve for the pulmonary artery. Here's a semilunar valve for the aorta. Right, so here's the aortic semilunar valve. All right, getting back to these atrioventricular valves, I see some strings coming down from them. These are little tendons that connect up to these muscles, look like fingertips inside of a ventricle. And these muscles are called papillary muscles. They look like little papillae poking into the ventricle. Attached on the apex of these papillae are what we call chordae tendineae. They attach to the valve leaflet, and it prevents the valve from flopping back all the way up into an atrium, which means that they would be very leaky if they were to do that. They wouldn't be a valve at all. All right, so these chorda tendineae make sure that these valve leaflets come together and actually form a nice tight seal separating the atria from the ventricle. So here is a valve leaflet, chorda tendineae, papillary muscles. I see some other muscles in a ventricle over here. We call these trabeculi carni. And I see trabeculi over here, trabeculi carni as well. All right, and how are you going to tell the difference between a papillary muscle and trabeculi? They might look similar in lab. How are you going to tell? Easy to see the difference on this slide, so I'm happy to point it out. A papillary muscle is always going to have chorda tendineae attached to it. So is this a papillary muscle here? Yes, chorda tendineae. Is this a papillary muscle here? Yes, because it has chorda tendineae. Is this a papillary muscle? Yes, there's chorda tendineae. What about this one here? Yes, and what about this one here? Yeah, all of those have chorda tendineae attached to them, so these are papillary muscles. What about this muscle here? Nope, no chorda tendineae, so this is trabeculi carni. Okay, there are some muscles in the atria that, which kind of look like trabeculi carni. They have a different name. I can see them just a little bit. They're not quite as extensive. These are what we call pectinate muscles. Pectinate muscles are in the atria. Trabeculi, trabecular muscles are in the ventricles. Here's that interventricular septum. All right, so all of these things are important to know. We've been talking about the vena cava, superior, inferior vena cava. What's the most anterior great vessel that you run into when you look at the anterior side of the heart? Here it is. Pulmonary what? Artery or vein? Artery. Even though it's blue? Could it be an artery even though it's blue? Yeah, because it's part of the pulmonary circulation, right? Okay. So the most anterior one, the first one you're going to run into in lab when we do our dissections is the pulmonary, and it's going to look a lot like this aorta because guess what? Nobody went in there with a magic marker and colored them red or blue. They're both going to kind of look white on the outside because of all the connective and elastic tissue, right? So you got to know them by location, not color. All right, and then it bifurcates into the left and right pulmonary artery. Let's look at, and then here are the pulmonary veins, right? The left pulmonary veins, right pulmonary veins. That's nice. Here is the aorta. The aorta has a number of different pieces to it. Since we're talking about the heart, let's talk about these pieces that are close to the heart. Here is a piece that is allowing blood to ascend superiorly from the heart. So this is what we call the ascending division of the aorta. Right, and then it arches around and starts to go posterior again. So here is the arch of the aorta. And then the last part, maybe I can see a little bit of it here, but it ends up down over here. So this is not ascending, this is taking blood inferiorly, so this is the descending aorta. And the descending aorta has got some different parts that we're going to look at in the next chapter. And where is this descending aorta? Is it anterior or posterior to the heart? Yeah, it's behind the heart, so we can't see it on these illustrations. But you know it's back there. Here's a little nubbin of it so that you can tell it's actually posterior to the heart. All right, three other blood vessels that are not labeled on this diagram, but you do have to know it for, well, the last test, right? Even on this particular figure. All right, this first branch off the arch of the aorta is called the brachiocephalic. Where did you run into brachio or brachium before? What does brachium mean? Arm. So here's a blood vessel taking blood to the arm, and cephalic, brachiocephalic. What does cephalic mean? It means toward the cephalic. Yeah, we didn't talk about this very much in this class. It means toward the head. Cephalic, it means toward the head. Caudal means toward your tail. So we don't use these terms very often because why? We don't have a tail, right? So it doesn't match up really nice. But cephalic means toward the head. So here is a blood vessel that is bringing blood to the right arm and the right side of the head. These two right here are going to do the job of the first one. So here's brachiocephalic. Here is the left common carotid. Common carotid takes blood to your head. And then here is the left artery that goes underneath the clavicle. So we call it the subclavian artery. All right, so let's name these three. You're going to have to look it up in your textbook, label it on your slide. I don't know if I drew in lead lines on the exam figures in your study guide, but these three you got to know. Brachiocephalic, you only have one, so you don't have to know right or left because there is no right or left. There's only one. And then here, these two go to the left side of the head. That's the common carotid. The left arm, which is the subclavian. All right, well, I said this one here, the brachiocephalic does the job of these two. So guess what happens to this brachiocephalic? Pretty close to the heart. It splits into two. And what does it split into? The right common carotid and the right subclavian matching up with these blood vessels that come off the arch of the heart. Okay. All right, so I'm going to look for an illustration for a second, but I'm going to give you a really hard question to answer. What are the names of blood vessels that come off the aorta first? The first blood vessels that come off the arch, not the arch, I'm sorry, the aorta. You know what? And I don't see them here. Oh, wow, I think I heard it someplace echoing back there. Okay, the first branch is not the brachiocephalic. That is the first branch on the arch. But remember, this is systemic circulation, but remember, systemic circulation also has to go to the heart, so the coronary arteries are the first branches from the aorta. And I can't see them. Let me see if I can see a picture of where they're located. Maybe I'll have to show them to you next time. I think maybe I have a... if not, I'll have to find a picture of them. Okay. Those come off the ascending aorta, so that's why we don't see them on this particular illustration. They come off over here. One goes to the left, one goes to the right, so there are two. There's a right coronary and left coronary artery. All right, so that's coronary circulation. All right, so we noticed that there are generally two kinds of chambers in the heart, right? There's not just right and left. But they're superior and inferior. The two superior are very similar and a lot different than the two inferior ones, right? So you got two atria, two ventricles. Now, we looked at cardiac muscle before. What are some specializations that cardiac muscle has that makes it different than skeletal muscle and smooth muscle? Most smooth muscle, anyway. Let's first think about the difference between cardiac and skeletal muscle. What's one difference? One is long. Is that what you're saying? They're both striated. They both have sarcomeres, so they both have actin and myosin in that same mechanical arrangement. Branch. Cardiac muscle is branched. Skeletal muscle is just straight without branches. We call that linear. That's pretty good. And cardiac muscles are short. And skeletal muscles are long, that means that there are a lot of junctions between cardiac muscle cells in the heart. So they have something special between cardiac muscle cells that glue them together so that when each of them contract, they don't pull apart. What are those things called? Those are intercalated discs, right? Well, not only does it keep those two cells approximate to each other so that they don't pull apart, but there's also some special connections, other connections, electrical connections between cells. Can you remember what those are called? Inside an intercalated disc that allows one muscle cell to communicate electrically with another, it's called a gap junction. It's a kind of synapse, right? Gap junction. And there's some details in this class. A gap junction is an electrical synapse, different than a chemical synapse, which means that if one heart cell gets excited and contracts, we call that depolarization. When one cell depolarizes, that electrical event flows through the gap junctions to all the cells of the heart. And so what does that mean? That means that the heart contracts as a unit, which is the way it has to contract in order to pump blood. Because if only the way left side of the left ventricle contracts and the septum relaxed, then the left side would pump blood over to the right side. And it wouldn't go into this artery. And that would be fatal. Right? So the whole heart has to contract as a unit so that it expels blood up into these arteries near the base of the heart. And so what the thing that makes sure that all of these muscle fibers contract together are those gap junctions. Right? That's an electrical synapse. All right. Now what about skeletal muscle? Does skeletal muscle have gap junctions? No. And why is that? Who could give me an example of why you wouldn't want that to happen? If skeletal muscle had gap junctions, what would happen to you? Say you reach out to get a Coca-Cola or something, what would happen if your skeletal muscles had gap junctions? All the skeletal muscles in your body would contract, right? So instead of reaching out, you would have biceps contracting and triceps, which means your arm couldn't move anywhere, right? You'd just go into a spasm. So you'd never want to think about getting a Coke because you'd be doing that all day long, right? All right, that's not good for skeletal muscle. That's great for cardiac muscle. All right, but here, when we look at these atria, the job of the atria is not only to collect blood, but to pump a little bit of blood into a ventricle so that the ventricles have some blood to pump. So in reality, the atria contract first before the ventricles. Both atria contract together, followed by the ventricles. Right. And that's because the connection between the atria and the ventricles does not have gap junctions. It is special. Right? So let's look at how special it is. All right, here it is. So here is what we call the fibrous skeleton of the heart. All right, it's connective tissue. It's in a plane between the atria and the ventricles. And this does not have gap junctions, so electrical signals can't go from an atria into the ventricles directly. That allows for the atria to contract first before the ventricles. And then here I can see some arrangements of valves. All right, so here is, what side of the heart is this over here? Hard to tell by looking at the picture right now. Here is anterior, then by definition here is posterior. What's the most anterior blood vessel coming off the base of the heart once again? Pulmonary. Do we see that here? Indeed we do, right? So here's the pulmonary artery. What's right behind the pulmonary? The aorta, right? And then we got some valves right between atria and ventricle, but they're not blood vessels, right? But here are those two blood vessels that you should know about. Okay, so signals can't get through this fibrous skeleton. The fibrous skeleton also acts as an anchoring to these rims of the valves inside the heart, right? So these are really tough stationary pieces of the heart that these valves are anchored into, and they have a particular shape, and since there's a lot of connective tissue here, they can't expand either, right? Because if the diameter of this valve all of a sudden got a lot bigger, then the valve leaflets wouldn't touch each other and it wouldn't be a valve. They'd be really leaky. The valve has to stay this diameter. Same for this one. Can't get any bigger. If it gets bigger, then this will no longer function as a valve because these cusps can't touch each other. In the vascular system, next chapter, we'll give you an example of what that causes in some people, unfortunately. All right, so that's the job of the fibrous skeleton. It electrically isolates the atria from the ventricles that are deep. It provides an anchor for all the valves of the heart, and it makes sure that the diameter of these blood vessels or the valves do not change, because otherwise they wouldn't work properly. Okay. Well, let's see what we got. We're almost done. I want to show you something where we're going to pick up next time. And where we're going to pick up next time has to do with the conduction system of the heart. And that's in this chapter, where do I have conduction system to show you? Right here. Or here. Okay, here's an exam figure. Can you see all the chambers in the heart? How many are there?
Four.
Yeah, there's four. What about valves? How many valves are there? Can we see all of them? I can only see three. Okay. And the pulmonary artery is missing so that we could look deep inside the heart. I see the aortic semilunar valve, but I don't see the pulmonary, which would be over here. It would be in the way to see these other structures that are yellow. All right, so these yellow structures are muscle cells. but they're specialized so that they do not contract, even though they're a muscle cell, but they have gap junctions in them, right, so that electrical impulses can flow down through these things. So even though they're muscle cells, they act more like a nerve inside the heart, even though they're muscle cells. Okay. All right, so there is a special place inside the right atrium that automatically generates electrical signals that will trigger a contraction. It's called the SA node. It's the pacemaker of the heart. It controls how fast the heart is going to beat. And that is in the right atrium. All right, and that electrical signal then flows over all of the atria. Eventually, it gets to this little node right here. It's called the AV node because it's right between an atrium and a ventricle. Right, and then it flows through the fibrous skeleton, through the atrioventricular bundle, and that's how electrical signals get into the ventricles so that they can contract. All right, but this allows the atria to contract together, but first before the ventricles, which will contract a little bit later, but they will both contract together. All right, so both atria contract first together, followed by both ventricles contracting together. And we need to describe a little bit more of what's going on with this conduction system, but look at your lecture notes before the next lecture and at least know the pieces of this conduction system so that when I talk about it, it will make more sense. Okay? What's happening next time? An exam. Ooh, I got to make an exam for you guys. Okay, and don't forget Friday for SI. See you next week. Don't forget signing sheets.
Sorry. Do you have a little for the plate for next week?